Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how much does a president truly matter for the direction of the United States and for the rest of the world? We'll speak with two experts on the forces that imprison our presidents. But first, who gets to vote? What are the laws that help or hinder the vote? How are those changing, and how might that affect the results of the 2020 election? With us to my left is University of Auckland policy and politics lecturer Tim Fadgen, who's also an American lawyer, and he's the author of Mental Health, Public Policy in Global Context. To my right is University of Auckland Associate Professor of American History Jennifer Frost, and she's the author of Let Us Vote, Youth Voting Rights and the 26th Amendment. Bertrall Ross joins us on Zoom. He is the University of California, Berkeley Chancellor's Professor of Law and the author of What the Constitution Owes the Poor, Equal Protection and a Path to Political Equality. What a week. It's been extraordinary. And now we've got so many uncertainties related to voting and the election, a pandemic, polarization, voter suppression tactics, what sounds like the threat of violence. I wonder if we can start with what exactly we are facing. What are the biggest issues? Tim Fadgen, would you like to start?
Thanks, Maria. Yeah, it's been a crazy week since we were last together, hasn't it? Just to stick with some of the points that we were trying to unpack last week and going into our topic for this week, just as a reminder, in the States, we use first past the post for our electoral system. It's important to remember that elections are not run by the federal government, but by each state. And that states get to decide, subject to some constitutional limitations, who can vote. And seats in the House are allocated by population amongst the states. And the districts are up to either legislatures or special commissions within states to draw. So there's a couple of issues that we wanted to kind of get to today. One has to do with voter eligibility. And the second one, gerrymandering, which is implicated in the second point that I just made. The first issue is really to do with eligibility to vote. There's been the pandemic causing some voter registrations in certain key states to plummet at certain points in time. States like North Carolina, Florida, and Arizona have seen some real pressure in this area. Some Democratic operatives, however, have looked at the Black Lives Matter movement as sort of a boon that led to some drive in certain registrations. But then we still end up with the problem of voter participation for the key demographic that is targeted here, 18 to 24. And some really interesting reporting lately on some innovations to try to reach younger voters in terms of using social media influencers and others to drive some of that registration.
I would like to bring Bertrall Ross in. What do you see as the big issues affecting the election in terms of who gets to vote and why or why not? What you think the effects might be?
Yeah, thank you, Maria, and thank you, Tim, for that background. I think some of the big issues that are arising with respect to voter eligibility have to do with some of the things that came up in prior elections, voter ID requirements, felon disfranchisement laws, and then you have more non-legal forms of voter suppression that has to do with using social media and other platforms to engage in a disinformation and misinformation campaign designed to mislead voters about how to vote, which is a big thing in this election with constantly changing adjustments to voting practices in states in response to the pandemic. So I'll touch on voter ID laws first. Voter ID laws haven't been as prominent of a feature in this particular election. They were much more in the 2016 election. Voter ID laws have a bit of a shelf life in the sense that once they're in place, there is a response by those who want to mobilize and activate those without voter IDs by providing them with resources and means to secure those voter IDs so that they can vote in the election. And in fact, studies have suggested that voter ID laws haven't had a tremendous effect on turnout because they contribute to a backlash in the sense that those who are targeted with voter ID laws tend to be activated and mobilized by that targeting and end up being more active participants in elections than they might have been without the voter ID law. So it's not clear what the effects are of voter ID laws. Now, one thing that does have a clear effect is felon disfranchisement laws. And these are laws that disfranchise persons who have been convicted of a felony. And the the disfranchisement can extend to the point where you're out of prison, or it can extend to the point at which you are finished with probation and parole, or it can extend to a lifetime in the sense that only the governor or some state official can restore your voting rights. The big sort of flashpoint in disfranchisement is Florida. And what happened in Florida is that the Florida voters passed a constitutional amendment that enfranchised persons with felony convictions once they completed their prison terms and parole and probation. It had exceptions for certain felony convictions, such as murder and sexual assault. But this would have had a tremendous effect on enfranchisement, given that many of the offenders who are disfranchised by these laws are those who have committed offenses like drug offenses and nonviolent felony offenses. But the state legislature in Florida followed up by passing legislation that required these individuals to pay all their fines before they can become eligible to vote. That issue was raised in the Supreme Court, and the Court of Appeals ultimately upheld those restrictions that are set forth in the Senate bill. Now, the third issue is the issue of misinformation and disinformation. To me, this is probably the biggest voter suppression concern of this election. What you're seeing through the use of robocalls, social media, is efforts to mislead voters in terms of how they can vote or the logistics of voting. And so you have old time practices in the sense of telling people that they could vote via the internet, or telling people that they can vote or they can't vote via mail, or telling people that if they do try to vote in a certain way, then their vote and they will be subject to scrutiny by the police or other authorities. And so these misinformation and disinformation campaigns are targeted towards racial minority communities in particular, who tend to vote Democratic in American elections. And the question that will be raised is, how do you counter that? How can you counter that effectively? And what might the effect be on turnout in this election?
One of the things I've been reading about, and I don't know if this is as big of an issue as it seems like in the media, is the obstructions in the capacity to vote by closing down polling stations in certain neighborhoods. And then, of course, we saw some shenanigans with the post office because the pandemic, of course, is making it difficult for people to go out and risk their lives if, in fact, there is, you know, a lot of COVID germs around. Bertrall, is this something that you are concerned about? And to what degree?
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate you raising that point. What you saw is the governor of Texas reduced the number of drop boxes in which individuals can drop off their ballots to one per county. And that is going to dramatically limit the opportunities to vote. What also you've seen in past elections that you're also going to see in this election is limiting the number of polls for voting in person, particularly in minority communities. In the past, the excuse that state officials made for limiting the number of polls in minority communities is because minorities didn't turn out as much as other segments of voters. And so these communities and neighborhoods didn't need as many polls. Observers didn't really see that connection, but that was the excuse that authorities made. Now state authorities have the excuse of the pandemic. And the excuse is based on, well, we don't have enough poll workers to man all of these polling places. And therefore, we need to reduce the number of polling places in the state. And if trends are consistent with the past, what you'll see is a disproportionate limiting of the number of polling places in minority communities. What this will lead to is long lines. During a pandemic, individuals will need to be socially distanced, so the longer lines will be made to seem even longer. And then the final factor is that the Trump campaign has been open about its efforts to secure so-called election observers to man the polls. Election protection observers, there's nothing objectionable about them in the abstract. They're perhaps to ensure that individuals can vote in a proper way and ensure the integrity of elections. But the way the Trump campaign seeks to marshal this resource, it seems, is to intimidate voters at the polls, maybe slow down voting by challenging voter qualifications at the polls, and contribute to voter attrition. Again, what Republicans are trying to get at is at the margins. They're trying to reduce the vote at the margins, not trying to disfranchise entire communities, but they're trying to reduce the votes of certain communities at the margins that will allow them to squeak out wins in particular states or particular districts. And so, yes, that effort is well underway and troubling to me.
Jennifer Frost, let's bring you in. Two questions. First of all, we know there's a history of voter intimidation and voter suppression in the United States and poll taxes and all kinds of things. So first of all, I'd like to get this into context, into the historical context of the United States. But also, historically, has this always been kind of more one party than the other, or have both parties engaged in this type of thing?
I think you're absolutely right about the main point. And we used to have this idea as U.S. historians of a progressive narrative of ever-increasing enfranchisement. And, you know, so going back to the 19th century, the early 19th century, you know, when property requirements were done away with. And then we see African-American men getting the right to vote after the Civil War. And then we see women getting the right to vote with the 19th Amendment in 1920. And, you know, on and on till we get 18, 19, and 20-year-olds being able to vote in 1971. And along the way, exactly, abolishing poll taxes, providing for a vote for Washington, D.C. You know, so we've seen this move toward greater enfranchisement. But that progressive story now has been very much challenged, that in some ways, with every step forward, there was a step back. So, you know, when propertyless men were then allowed to vote in the 1830s, let's say, African American men would have to have property to vote. So it was exactly that, you know, one step forward, one step back in a sense. So yes, that's a long history here. I think the other thing, though, because we have this history, because we have these suffrage amendments, as they're called, we have mechanisms. I think what's been frustrating to me to see as a historian is that, boy, once you achieve these amazing goals like these amendments, and the enforcement clause in all these amendments gives Congress the power to enforce, you know, if there's any denial or abridgment of voting rights, the Congress has the power to act. And we basically have not. And we've known the problem since, you know, certainly 2000 at the very least. And, you know, it keeps happening and we keep not being able to do something. Just as a point of interest, the current Congress, the House of Representatives, their very first piece of legislation was H.R. 1, which was essentially a voting rights bill. And so I guess, yes, long history, but we also have some tools. And in the right hands, maybe we can actually, you know, fix some of these problems.
Tim Fadgen, let's bring you back in. Last week, we started to talk about some of the things that happened in 2000 and in 2016. 2000 in Florida, I remember both the confusing butterfly ballots, secondly, the purges of certain people from the voter rolls that seemed to be largely of African-American descent. And then we saw the Supreme Court step in and essentially invalidate an election by stopping the count of the vote. What do you make of this, Tim Fadgen?
Well, a couple of things I guess I would add to give some further context to Jennifer's great historical view of this. In theory, like we were saying before, if you look at in the big picture, once you reach the age of 18 on election day, you're eligible to vote. So in theory, we've got about 250 million odd people in the United States who should be eligible to vote. If we go back to 2016, your question, those figures showed only 230 million people who were actually eligible that were 18 plus at that time. So what about those 20 million, which is what you're getting at? Just to, you know, remember to put that into context, that's about four times the population of New Zealand that would be eligible to vote. But for one reason or another, typically because of a felony conviction or you're a non-citizen. So if you have a green card in the United States, unlike here in New Zealand, where permanent residents are extended a right to vote, you have no say. So, and this differs by state, where we've got states like California that have 16% of their voting age population is ineligible to vote, Texas 13%. And if we take a look at felons, it's even more stark. We have 3 million across the United States, more or less, but one third of these are concentrated in Texas, Georgia, and Florida, which get to your sort of issues around disenfranchisement of Black voters and Latinx in particular.
This is The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. And we're talking about voting in the USA. Who can vote? And how will this impact the 2020 election outcome? With me is Bertrand Ross. He's the University of California, Berkeley, Chancellor's Professor of Law. And my two colleagues from the University of Auckland, historian Jennifer Frost and Tim Fadgen, lecturer of politics and policy. Everybody's skipping my question. So, Bertrand, would you please?
Yeah, so I think that it is one party that is the source of disfranchisement efforts now, but it was another party that was the source of disfranchisement efforts in the past. If you look at the post-Civil War, post-passage of the 15th Amendment, which granted or prohibited the denial or abridgment of the right to vote on account of race or color, you saw Democratic efforts, particularly in the South, to disfranchise African Americans. Now, remember, the Democratic Party was a party of slavery. It was a party of that held the belief that this is a white man's government. And they tried to enforce that belief by active suppression efforts. And these suppression efforts were different from those in the present. The suppression efforts in the past were designed to disfranchise an entire community. They wanted to eliminate the Black presence in the polity as voters. And they successfully did so. So that by 1900, very few African-Americans in the South were eligible to vote. And if they were eligible to vote, they typically would not vote for fear of violence or intimidation. Now we see the efforts that are made by the Republican Party, which has emerged as a party of white racial grievances, at least in this particular election. And they're targeting, again, voters on the margin. They know that they're not going to be able to disfranchise entire communities. The fact is that there are constitutional amendments that have been passed that protect communities from being disfranchised in the way that the Democrats attempted to do so back after the Reconstruction period. But now what they're using are the fact that you can pass laws that have a disparate impact, so long as those laws are not motivated by discriminatory intent. So the passage of laws like voter ID laws that Republican lawmakers know will have a disparate impact on minority and poor communities are passed because they know that these minority and poor communities tend to vote Democratic. And so it's an effort to limit or to diminish the number of voters in these communities, to deter enough voters in these communities to skirt by to win elections. And it was effective in states like Wisconsin, which passed a voter ID law prior to the 2016 election. Hillary Clinton, in her book, What's Happened, is firmly convinced that that voter ID law provided the margin of victory for Trump in that state. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but there's it's a possibility at least.
I think there was also around that time also the Georgia election, the gubernatorial election that dealt with Stacey Abrams running for governor. Her opponent was Secretary of State and had some power over the voter rolls. Jennifer Frost.
Well, I was just thinking about this issue about that disparate impact and, you know, in a way, sort of the cleverness of the legislation that we see in this case now, the party of disfranchisement, which is the Republicans passing. And it's so hard to prove, you know, what the intent is. But I was just thinking, you mentioned the Texas situation where the governor there has put one polling place per county and people are openly calling it voter suppression. That move by that governor would have been impossible under a section of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 called preclearance, which had identified certain states with a long history that Bertrand's just shared with us of voter disenfranchisement, with having to get new laws about eligibility or registration or voting cleared, pre-cleared by the Justice Department. In a Supreme Court case, Shelby v. Holder, I think it was 2011, that preclearance was seen as discriminatory against these states and unnecessary. And the argument from the Chief Justice at the time, John Roberts, was, look, African Americans are voting. They've elected a Black president. We don't have this problem anymore. Let's get rid of preclearance. And then I remember Ruth Bader Ginsburg, may she rest in peace, said, it's like having an umbrella in the rain and saying, I'm not getting wet, so I throw away my umbrella, more or less, right? And so I think right there we have, you know, an indictment of the Shelby v. Holder Supreme Court decision.
How much difference might all of these collectively make in this coming election? Do you have a sense of that, Bertrand Ross?
the disfranchisement efforts and voter suppression efforts, we don't know. It turns on a couple of factors that are just unknowable right now. How motivated are individuals to vote? How much counter information that they're getting that is used to counteract these disinformation and misinformation campaigns? And then how well the Republicans will be able to mobilize poll workers or election observers to exercise in intimidation tactics. So there's a variety of factors that will come into play. It will certainly be a non-zero number of voters that will be deterred. Now, the question is whether it will be enough to turn an election in a particular state. If things hold up where they stand now, and if the polls are to be believed, I don't think that voter suppression tactics will be enough to get Trump over the finish line in a favorable position. But if the polls tighten up in critical states, then it's a possibility that that margin of deterrence, that margin of voter deterrence that you're able to achieve through voter suppression laws might edge the election in favor of Trump, whereas it would have perhaps been in favor of Biden in the absence of these voter suppression tools. So we just don't know. There's a month ahead. There's a lot, as you see in American politics with respect to what's gone on in the past week, a whole lot happens in a week. I'm reminded of a Slate columnist who said 2 months before the election, just hit me over with a sledgehammer so I could sleep until after the election, right? Because this anxiety and stress surrounding American politics right now is extremely high. So we just don't know, but I suspect if things remain the same with respect to polls, I don't think they'll have much of an effect. But if they tighten up, I think they could.
Tim Fadjin, how concerned are you that they will have an effect on the election?
Well, I think just to pick up on one of Bertrand's points, I mean, it reminds us of just how much has changed since last week. And thinking about the voter suppression, voter intimidation, President Trump's statement to his supporters, to the white nationalists to sort of stand back and stand by, even though he's tried to backtrack a bit on that, he still is insisting on his supporters being out at the polls, sort of serving as a extra partisan check on people's access to the polls potentially. And if you combine this with some of the comments raised today about voting in the pandemic, social distancing, long queues at limited spaces, and you just have the potential for a very volatile situation. And how much are people willing to be intimidated during a pandemic, subjected to potential violence at a polling space, is a real concern. So, yeah.
Jennifer Frost.
Yeah, I mean, agree with everything that you've been saying. But I think it's really important that the secretaries of states, the attorney generals of states have come out reminding people that voter intimidation is illegal. Yes, you can be a poll observer, but intimidation is illegal and we're going to enforce it. I think the attorney general of Nevada said that. One thing that I think is unique in this election and I think potentially could have certainly make a difference at the margins is how many Republican voters are coming out against Trump. So there's a number of national security figures, political figures, but organizations, Republican Voters Against Trump, Project Lincoln, Republicans for Biden, et cetera. And they are people who vote. And they're not going to be disenfranchised, and they're voting for Biden because they have had enough with Trump. And the latest polls say something like 8 to 10% of likely to vote Republicans would vote for Biden. And part of that was added to with the debate performance, where some of these Republicans just
shifted
said,
Florida quite a
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, we can't. You know, vote for this man again. So that's another new, unique situation, I think, especially in such a polarized atmosphere that, you know, we're going to have some Republicans voting for Biden.
Is anybody concerned about hacking voting machines, or is that something that is not of a concern, Bertrand Ross?
I'm concerned about everything with this election, and hacking voting machines is just another. And it's one of the things that's most concerning is that it's kind of fallen off of the agenda or fallen to a pretty low point in the agenda. Nobody's really talking about it. We may be getting a false sense of security about our voting machines that we're fine because nobody is talking about it. But the vulnerabilities that existed in 2016 are still there. Now, have there been efforts to improve the security of voting machines? Certainly. Have there been enough efforts to secure? No. And I think that is a major concern, because I think that Russia is very interested in this election and other countries are very interested in this election. And they have the tools and capacity to engage in hacking enterprises that can really disrupt our voting. And you don't necessarily have to shift an election entirely in favor of one candidate or the other. All you have to do is sow enough doubt in the results. You sow enough doubt in the results and you combine it with a candidate who has already asserted that he will question the legitimacy of the outcome of the election unless he considers it to be a fair and free election, which means an election that he wins, then that combination could lead to a very volatile situation after the election. And it would provide the means, as Tim says, to mobilize violence potentially and disorder after the election. And that is really concerning to me. So all of these variables, all these factors almost have to go exactly right in order to avoid a very volatile and dangerous situation after the election.
Would you call this, Jennifer Frost, all of these things together, as a historian, would you call this unprecedented?
Yeah. No, hands down, yes. I mean, you know, as a historian, we're often trying to say, oh, no, you know, this has happened before, et cetera. But the combination of factors, I mean, even the fact that Trump has this COVID diagnosis. Yes, we've had presidents with medical emergencies and medical treatments, having to happen, but not this close to an election, and just every other factor, coming into play. So no, it is unprecedented. And I know people say, oh, it's the most important election of our lives. Those of us sort of, half a decade on or whatever. But to me, everybody, historians would say it's the most important election since 1860, before the United States went to war as a civil war.
Bertrand Ross?
Let's hope for the best for the U.S. elections, because I think that the success of our democracy will very much turn on the success of this election. So
thank you so much, all of you, for this really important and an interesting discussion, too.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Bertrand.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, how much does a president truly matter for the direction of the United States and for the rest of the world? We'll speak with two experts on the forces that imprison our presidents. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How much does the president truly matter for the direction of the United States and for the rest of the world? We're joined by William Grover and Joseph Peshek. William Grover is professor of political science at St. Michael's College in Vermont and the author of The President as Prisoner. Joseph Peshek is professor of political science at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota, and the author of Policy Planning Organizations, Elite Agendas in America's Rightward Turn. Together, they have co-authored the book we'll be talking about, The Unsustainable Presidency, Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Beyond. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the two of you here with us. I thought the way you opened the book was quite compelling with this BP oil spill and President Obama's response to it, and his daughter asking her dad if he had plugged the hole yet. How do you see this as indicative of the unsustainable presidency? Bill Grover?
Well, first of all, thanks for having us on, Maria. The example was used to point out the fact that in the 20th and 21st centuries, the public kind of expects the president, regardless of party, to respond to all manner of crises in the world and crises at home. And we're just trying to point out that that attitude, that the president is the first kind of place you go to for correcting problems, that attitude is fairly new. It's kind of a New Deal, a post-New Deal phenomenon. And that when you look at the 19th and 20th centuries, in fact, people with grievances would look more to their state governments or to Congress for help, not to the president. So we're just trying to make a point there about how people's view of the office and the importance of office and the centrality of the office in helping people with their lives, that view has shifted over time.
Joe Peshek, what would you add?
Well, as Bill pointed out, there's been a shift in public perceptions of the presidency. And I guess what we're doing in a nutshell is not trying to argue that the presidency is not powerful, is not unimportant, but to look at the underlying factors in society, in our economic system, the constraints that limit, by and large, the range of actions presidents can take, at least on, you know, very important economic, foreign policy, national security issues, and so forth. And so we're trying to draw attention to ways in which social conditions and things other than just like the president's relationship with Congress, which of course is very important, but things a little bit more structural sort of shape the terrain on which presidents task, but I may be kind of anticipating a later discussion.
Yeah, definitely. But that's okay. You gave us a little preview. I think there's a lot in there that I want to get into. I wonder if we could talk about, before we even get into the kind of structural analysis that you guys did, particularly as it links to Bill Grover's previous work, The President is Prisoner, which I always found to be a fascinating idea. But before we even get there, I wonder if we could walk through how much the presidency has changed over time in terms of what the job really entails. You did this really wonderful job in the first chapters talking about the various presidents and what their approach was, as well as the different theoretical ideas. Bill Grover, why don't you give us a sense of how things have changed?
It's a good question. Public expectations have certainly risen, but here's a little experiment you could do in LA or where you are now in New Zealand. Just go ask somebody on the street to name a 19th century president. And if you get somebody to mention someone other than Abraham Lincoln, you're pretty lucky. Particularly name a president after the Civil War in the 19th century. It's not impossible, but most people have no idea. The president was not that central a figure in public life. So with the exception of Lincoln, acting in times of crisis, in fact, the greatest crisis the U.S. ever faced during the Civil War, with the almost lone exception of Lincoln, people could come up with some names, but wouldn't really know much of anything, if at all, about those presidencies, because in fact, the presidency wasn't that central a figure, a player in the American political economy for most of the 19th century. They basically did the bidding of business, particularly after the Civil War, they basically did the bidding of big business during the Industrial Revolution and the Gilded Age. And beyond that, the president really wasn't responding to popular concerns. That obviously changes with FDR in the teeth of the New Depression, in the teeth of the Great Depression, and the New Deal programs that came forward. But you know, prior to Roosevelt, it was not a particularly executive-centered view of the world.
Would you say that from early in the U.S. history that this bidding for big business has really been the central focus even from the very beginning?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And of course, the economy of the United States has changed tremendously. And if I can refer to a popular, I think, Broadway play, Hamilton, we talked a little bit about Alexander Hamilton's analysis of the presidency early on, who really did see a kind of a link between a strong presidency and an active state and working with the major financial and manufacturing sectors of the economy to promote national development. But I guess I would say that Hamilton might be kind of a forerunner of the corporate state that really developed in the 20th century, where you had the development of large corporations and financial institutions. So you know, I think our analysis kind of focuses on the so-called modern presidency, which most political scientists, including ourselves, would date from FDR, although there were some earlier hints of that earlier in the 20th century. But the connection between the corporate model of economic growth and the presidency is, at least to my way of thinking, and Bill might disagree with this, is the development of corporate capitalism we see in the late 19th and the 20th century. And it was a somewhat different system before that.
Bill Grover, do you agree?
Yeah, I agree with that. I do agree with that. And I think that Joe is correct that Hamilton was ahead of his time. He had a vision. I tell my students sometimes that Hamilton's the most important political figure they've never heard of or can't even explain. No, yeah, we hear a lot about Washington and Jefferson and maybe even James Madison. But until until this play came along, people hadn't paid a lot of attention to Hamilton, at least not in popular culture. But he was way, way ahead of his time, as Joe said, in terms of using the a combination of business power and political power to get things done. And until the United States emerges from the Civil War and actually can begin to develop a national economy, until that happens, Hamilton's plans, although the plan for the National Bank was there before that, but other than the plan for the National Bank, Hamilton's vision is not really realized until the latter part of the 19th and throughout the 20th century.
You were critical of, say, for example, Woodrow Wilson's assertion that he was for big business but opposed to monopolies, monopolistic trusts. How does this all fit in with your argument? Bill Grover.
Well, I think coming out of the progressive era, Wilson was, as were many progressives, not that he was a progressive, but many people were very, very wary of corporate power. Louis Brandeis, the Supreme Court Justice, talked about how we can have, you know, democracy on the one hand, or we can have concentration of corporate power on the other hand, but we can't have both. So the idea that corporate power during Wilson's time could undermine democracy was there, but in no way were those folks, particularly Wilson, critical of capitalism as an economic system. They were critical of massive concentrations of corporate power, but they didn't have a fundamental criticism of the way that the business in general interacts with the political sphere. So sure, so when we use that one quote from Wilson that frames a second chapter, it's an interesting quote. He takes the argument up to a certain point, but beyond that point, he's not going to be critical of the economic system per se, only the excesses of the economic system in the hands of corporate power, as seen throughout the progressive era, when a critique of that became very, very important.
And if I could just add to that briefly, we have to remember in the early parts of the 20th century, there was a real upsurge of various types of radicalism in the United States, the labor movement, anarchism, socialism, radical feminism, new black strivings, W.E.B. Du Bois. And so, yeah, that's also a context, because there were definitely people in what we might call the establishment who were very nervous that, you know, these sorts of calls for fundamental change and radicalism might go too far. And the more far-sighted members of the ruling group, in which I would include Wilson, sort of recognized that in order to maintain the system that we have, we're going to have to make certain concessions. And the same could be said of FDR, by the way, too. FDR in 1936, when he was running for election, I mean, he did sort of excoriate those who hated him, but he also said, we saved the system. So that's the kind of perspective we're bringing, too, to sort of see this balancing act where presidents kind of have to lift themselves up from any one particular economic group in order to devise plans to maintain the system as a whole.
And if I could just add to that, when we're challenging the conventional faith that the institutions of government, particularly the executive branch interacting with the legislative branch, when he and I challenged this conventional faith that the institutions will self-correct, when we challenge that, we emphasize there's a very, very powerful political and economic structure, but we also emphasize, of course, the efficacy of social movements, that the only way you can really challenge that kind of structural corporate political power nexus is with social movements. And so when Joe points out that during the progressive era, and again, certainly during the Great Depression and the New Deal, those social movements were absolutely crucial in extracting concessions from political and economic leaders.
Well, I thought that your examples, both in this book and Bill Grover in your previous book, that were most powerful were the ideas of the economic strike, of the economic elite going on strike, and what that really does to an economy. And that's how power gets checked in presidents, whoever the president might be. And you used several examples of this. So why don't you explain exactly what you mean by this structure that keeps presidents in check and keeps their power limited?
The structural argument that we make throughout the book suggests that both in terms of how, regardless of party, whether a Democrat or Republican is in the White House, regardless of the personality, whether their personality is more outgoing or inward looking, regardless of their management style, are they good delegators, or are they people who like to keep control of the details themselves, regardless of those are the kind of factors that conventional political science look to when they analyze the executive in the White House. And what Joe and I are suggesting is that what lies beneath the party and the personality and the management style is a certain definition of economic growth and a certain definition of national security, both of which are absorbed by both political parties, so that when, for example, you're trying to explain why every 4 years people get all excited about this quadrennial hoopla thing we call the presidential election, and, you know, voter turnout in 2008 can skyrocket for Barack Obama and can remain pretty healthy in 2012, people get their expectations up pretty high, maybe not so much in 2016. And one of the questions that Joe and I was probing was, why are those expectations so routinely shattered on the shoals of reality? And in part because both parties share a similar definition of economic growth and national security, and so that the political and economic structure frames issues, policy issues, in ways that are in line with kind of conventional definitions of growth. You know, how do we define growth? We should define economic growth as, let's have greater gross domestic product this year than we had last year. Let's have greater GDP next year than we had this year, on and on and on, up and up and up. And all you have to do is listen to Hillary Clinton in that first debate talk about her relief in economic growth. That view of economic growth is no longer sustainable in an era of climate change. And so, and similarly, in an era of declining U.S. power in the world, declining U.S. hegemony, the idea that we can pursue national security with just bigger defense budgets and by being militarily assertive, the kind of national security credo that we talk about in some of our other articles, those assumptions are no longer sustainable either in a world of declining U.S. power. So the structure is the way that conventional thinking frames in both political parties the way we address the key policy issues. Are there differences in policy issues? Of course. If you are a huge supporter of LGBT rights, then it makes a difference if there's a Democrat in the White House versus a Republican. But when it comes to the major kind of definitional issues of the modern presidency, a certain definition of economic growth, endless economic growth, and a certain definition of national security, you're not going to get much difference from the two political parties. And that's because the debate is structured in certain ways that reflect political and economic power.
Joe Peschek?
Well, I think you mentioned the idea of the capital strike, Maria, and that would be one example of how structural economic factors could affect the presidency. And, you know, in a nutshell, it's that presidents are so sensitive to the views of the business community, because in a capitalist society, the investment and employment decisions of the business community make a big difference in the state of the economy, and the state of the economy matters greatly to presidents, that they have what some scholars would call kind of an automatic punishing mechanism, in the sense that presidents, knowing that capital might go on strike if they don't like the policies of the presidency, acts to block a presidency from pursuing more progressive policies in the first place. And actually, this idea has been developed by people from a number of different perspectives, not just on the left, but Charles Lindblom, for example, famously, who was president of the American Political Science Association. So that's a kind of a structural factor that doesn't really require business corporations, for example, to explicitly lobby the government. It's just, again, it's kind of a recoil mechanism, you know, the belief in business confidence. Now, I think we use the term structural maybe a little bit eclectically. We talk about capital dominance and class dominance. And so the capital strike might be kind of the dominance of capital just per se. But we also acknowledge that another type of structural constraint is just the massive advantages that corporations and the wealthy have to influence government through more voluntary means, like campaign contributions, like lobbying, like having their representatives appointed to government or to set up think tanks that influence the policy process. So we're calling, you know, both of those levels corporate influence structural, at least with respect to economic issues.
Could you say what you mean by capitalist strike?
Capital strike is the ability of large corporations to punish policymakers for the policy decisions, to punish them instantaneously through changes in investment policies and employment policies that are registered daily on the stock market and in other ways as well. So, for example, if you really had a push for the 15-hour minimum wage, if you really had a push for something even much more radical than if Bernie Sanders, for example, had won the Democratic nomination and was really pushing for national health care or something, the threat of serious challenges to the way we normally define economic growth, would encourage businesses to go on strike. The word strike is in quotes. It's the kind of business version of a labor strike, whereas a labor strike requires lots of coordination and lots of hardship on the part of ordinary people, perhaps losing their jobs or perhaps going on strike and not having a paycheck for a week or two or three. Capital strike happens instantaneously when businesses shift their investments at the stroke of a computer key, and those register daily in terms of a declining stock market. So, for example, when Joe and I talked about, well, in our sixth chapter, this is well before Bernie Sanders declared his run for the presidency, when we suggested, okay, what would happen if Bernie Sanders was actually to win the nomination for the presidency? And we talk about how the reaction of business would be swift and negative, and that, you know, weeks and weeks and weeks before he would take the oath of office in January of 2017, successful candidate Bernie Sanders in November of 2016 would be facing declining business confidence and a capital strike, and would have to then be called upon to do things like, perhaps he would be pressured to tailor the appointments he would make to his cabinet. He would be highly pressured to appoint into key positions, the Commerce Department and Treasury Department and such, the kinds of people who would mollify and calm the markets. For example, when Barack Obama came to power in 2009, you get the what was sometimes referred to as his economic aid team, you know, Robert Rubin and Larry Summers and Tim Geithner and those kinds of guys. Now, Obama wasn't facing capital strike, but they would be, if you really had a candidate who fundamentally challenged the power structure, you would have tremendous pressure during that 11-week period to name people to key positions who would mollify those who might engage in capital strikes.
Let's put some of the policies that you examined from the last three presidents into this context and help us to understand why things went the way they did, both with economic issues and also with foreign policy. So maybe we should start with Bill Clinton. Joe Pasek?
Of course, Bill Clinton, too, ran on a campaign of change in 92 and ending three terms for the Republicans having the White House. And when he campaigned for president, he said he was concerned about the budget deficit, but he also, just to take this one issue, said we have a public investment deficit as well, and I want to spend money on infrastructure, on job training, and a number of other things. Okay, and he prioritized that. But, you know, as an example of what we were just talking about in this business confidence argument, even during the transition, after he had been elected, but before he became president in January of 93, he learned that the federal budget deficit was higher than had been forecast and immediately came under pressure from Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan and other people that, you know, dealing with the economy really requires reinsuring financiers and investors that we can bring the budget deficit down. And as it turned out, indeed, Clinton's public investment, more progressive side of his legislation, was largely jettisoned. It had a lot of opposition from the Republicans. I don't want to minimize that. And, you know, he found himself increasingly focused on deficit reduction. And as we explained, quoting an account from Bob Woodward, he himself recognized that his agenda was to some extent being dictated by the need to satisfy the bond market, very famously, and that, you know, he was caught in a quandary he didn't quite control, because now the agenda was, in order to restore economic growth, we have to take measures to reinsure investors, and what they want to see is a focus on budget reduction rather than public investment. So I think actually early Clinton presidency, particularly his first budget battles, do illustrate pretty well the kind of pressures that Bill was just talking about that presidents face to reassure the business community. And of course, many other examples could be given from Clinton, too, and in foreign policy as well.
Bill Grove, is there anything you'd like to add to that?
You could also add to that in 1999, for example, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which Clinton was hugely in favor of, that the 1933 law that separated commercial banking from investment banking. And with the repeal of Glass-Steagall, every bank was allowed to play, you know, part of casino capitals, involve themselves in big investments. And so the repeal of Glass-Steagall, lowering the capital gains tax rate, collectively what became known as Clintonomics, was really a fairly conservative approach, a fairly neoliberal approach to economic policy. And you can see that also in welfare reform when he ran for re-election in 1996. And so when it comes to NAFTA or welfare reform or the repeal of Glass-Steagall, a whole range of economic policies, the budget battles that Joe referred to, you can see that that kind of set of priorities was at work for Bill Clinton, and certainly was at work later on for Barack Obama, too, who also campaigned on a change you can believe in. So I think that adherence to late 1980s, early 1990s neoliberal policies is a constant now for the chief executive, be he or she a Democrat or a Republican. So that also helps explain, I think, people's dissatisfaction that change doesn't really happen. But with Clinton, he was part of that Democratic Leadership Council, New Democrat Response, which really was a more conservative Democratic Party after Joe said three consecutive terms with Republicans in charge.
What about with foreign policy?
A couple of points there with respect to Clinton specifically. He's the first president elected after the fall of the Cold War. And the 1990s were also, you know, the decade in which globalization became a buzzword. So just to take those up, in terms of globalization, the Clinton administration, we think, really embraced neoliberalism, not just in terms of domestic policy, but in terms of international economic policy, too. You know, most notably in so-called free trade agreements like NAFTA, and just in terms of the general paradigm that the opening of markets will lead to democracy, democratization will lead to peace. I mean, there was a very strong neoliberal streak to Clinton's approach to global political economy. The other thing, though, in terms of national security policy is it's really significant that, you know, Clinton did actually deploy military force on quite a number of occasions, maybe more than people realize, in the Balkans and also against Iraq, too. It was under Clinton that the, I'm misremembering the name of the legislation, but sort of calling for regime change in Iraq was passed, something that he, in 1998 legislation that Clinton supported, and in some ways signals George W. Bush's war against Iraq in the next decade. Even though now it's a post-Cold War period, you think, well, the Soviet Union not around anymore, and so that will lead to a new American national security strategy. I mean, the emphasis on American global leadership or hegemony, we think that's the real, you know, key factor. Cold War or not, again, modern American presidents, be they Democrat or Republican, liberal or conservative, are very much committed to the goal of maintaining American global dominance. And of course, to justify that, we hear so much about American exceptionalism. You know, and we hear that from Hillary Clinton, we hear that from Republicans. That's kind of the ideology that supports it, I might say. We think that Clinton kind of carried on the national security imperative that we talk about in a post-Cold War setting.
If we were to compare, say, the last three presidents, Clinton, Bush, Barack Obama, I know that you said you see quite a bit of continuity across them, particularly with economic policies, but we also see differences. How important are those differences, Bill Grover?
I think the differences are often emphasized a lot by the media because it helps reinforce the idea that we have, you know, two vibrant different points of view that are contesting for, you know, economic policy and foreign policy issues. So I think that we often hear about the differences, but I think substantively in terms of the actual conduct of U.S. foreign policy, one could make an argument, for example, that the pervasive use of drone strikes in Pakistan and Yemen and other countries, Afghanistan, by President Obama was actually exceeded the amount of interventionism that President George W. Bush engaged in. Of course, he had the war in Iraq. I think the differences are dwarfed by the continuities, which tends to look at foreign policy through an economic lens and through a lens of strengthening U.S. power in the world.
You know, not to undercut our argument, and this doesn't, but there are differences in sort of ruling circles about what the best strategy is for attaining the goals of economic growth and American global dominance. And so there are differences between the Bush administration, the Obama administration, and there are also differences within each administration, sort of internal factions. For example, under Obama, he's appointed people who are regarded in terms of national security as quite liberal, Samantha Powers, maybe Susan Rice, but, you know, they're liberal hawks, too. That's the thing. The neoliberal hawks or the liberal hawks, in many ways, share commitments to American military intervention and so forth with the neoconservatives, who we heard so much about under George W. Bush. You know, it's not a static set of imperatives. It gets played out in different ways. There are debates over what strategies and particular policies would best ensure the overall goals. We tried to take that into account, too.
We have seen differences with economic approaches domestically. So, for example, we do see big economic downturns under presidents like Bush, and we see them getting considerably better under President Obama, although the economic inequality continues.
There are differences, Maria, for sure. As Joe said, we're not all suggesting that there aren't differences, but we just think that the similarities are much greater. So, for example, both President George W. Bush and Barack Obama had economic recovery packages. They got stimulus packages that they got through Congress. They were similar in size, the high $700 billion range. Both were going to help bail out Wall Street in response to the Great Recession. They very, very similar kind of policy, but there are differences in terms of how they sell those policies and differences in terms of whether they believe that government intervention per se can have a helpful impact. President Bush, George W. Bush, had to be, you know, dragged kicking and screaming into supporting a stimulus package, and Barack Obama was much more supportive, but he was not at all supportive of the size of a stimulus package, for example, that many, many economists, liberal and radical economists, said the stimulus package should be more in the range of $1.5 trillion, perhaps. So neither one is going to really endorse a massive investment strategy to bail us out, or to bail out the ordinary person as opposed to bailing out Wall Street. Maybe even a better example would be the Affordable Care Act, which I think we are better off that the Affordable Care Act was passed. I think that, you know, with having an additional 26 million people have health care is a wonderful thing. But, you know, there was no fire in the belly in Congress, and certainly none from President Obama, in terms of having a public option. It was on the table very briefly. Public option, it might move us towards single payer. So the Affordable Care Act got no Republican support in Congress. The Democrats are going to support that. That's a significant difference. And I think it would be silly to say that wasn't a difference. It is important that we've had that piece of legislation pass. So that's the difference. But the similarity is that neither party, maybe outside Bernie Sanders, is going to champion a single-payer healthcare system along the lines of a Canadian system or a German system or a French system. So there are differences and there are similarities, but we think overall the differences, the barriers beyond which neither party will go, are pretty similar.
The book is called The Unsustainable Presidency, and we've been speaking with the authors William Grover and Joseph Peshek. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Maria.
Thanks for having us very much.
William Grover is professor of political science at St. Michael's College in Vermont and the author of The President as Prisoner. Joseph Peshek is professor of political science at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota, and the author of Policy Planning Organizations, Elite Agendas in America's Rightward Turn. Together, they have co-authored the book The Unsustainable Presidency, Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Beyond. Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholars Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.